correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along with me to Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, for a visit with Daniel Martinez, National Park Service Chief Historian for the World War II Valor in the Pacific National Monument. Martinez's areas of responsibility include the USS Arizona Memorial and Visitor Center, the USS Utah Memorial, the Oklahoma Memorial, and other historic sites along Pearl Harbor's Battleship Row. Martinez shares his personal journey of understanding World War II and the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. His lifelong quest of understanding starts in Lone Pine, California, and takes him to Japan for a powerful reconciliation ceremony in the mountains. His grandfather was working as a civilian at Pearl Harbor on the Day of Infamy, and many of his relatives fought in World War II. Martinez has spent the past 3 decades as the National Park Service Chief Historian at the World War II Valor in the Pacific National Monument, where in addition to interviewing hundreds of Pearl Harbor survivors, Martinez has had the honor of personally escorting 4 U.S. presidents, George H.W. Bush, George Walker Bush, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama, on engaging Pearl Harbor tours. Come along and join National Park Ranger and Chief Historian Daniel Martinez for a personal journey and remembrance of his lifelong affiliation with Pearl Harbor and World War II, along with insights about planned events in commemoration of the 75th anniversary of the December 7, 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor. National Park Ranger Daniel Martinez.
Hi, Daniel.
Hi, how are you? Aloha. Welcome to Hawaii.
Thank you for taking the time to visit. I know this is a crazy time for y'all. You're coming up on the 75th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor in days, and you are in the bullseye here.
Well, there's a lot of us that are in the bullseye, so to speak, but we're on the home stretch, and there's a lot of work still yet to be done and development. We're working on a new event for the symposium in November, so yeah, it's one of those wonderful times where we commemorate, but the stress of doing that is part of the job.
Tell us about the breadth of what the National Park Service here will be doing.
Well, we have scheduled a number of events, and you can actually go to pearlharborevents.com to see it. It'll link you to the 75th anniversary. But we have over 50 events over an 11-day period. The veterans, for them, it's going to be the last time they come. We have the Arizona survivors coming, of which there are only 5 left. 4 of them will be coming, and that's going to be special. We have a double interment, 2 of the Arizona survivors that passed away recently, Mr. Anderson and Mr. Hetrick, are going back to the ship, and I'm in the midst of planning that because I'm the internment officer, and Scott Pawlowski is a dive officer, Park Service a diver that will be working with the MPS dive team and the Navy to bring their ashes back to the ship and inter them. So that is a huge responsibility and one that we are now in the midst of planning. It's one that takes you back to the days of 1941 almost immediately because they were there, and their wish to be back with their shipmates is what we're ensuring. And it's not only a responsibility, but it's an honor to do that.
Quite powerful.
It is powerful. It's the only place in America where something like this takes place in which the former shipmates go back to their ship.
Tell us about some of the other programs that you're most proud of and fascinated by.
Well, certainly the interfaith service. We bring all the faiths of the world that we can get together to offer their prayer inside the shrine room, the USS Arizona Memorial. And we have a variety of Christian faiths represented, Buddhist faith, Shinto, Muslim will be here. So it's an idea of the religions that make up America are welcome to be part of this prayer service, and we're still reaching out. So to see that happen, for those that are believers in that, we make that available. And so myself, as a Roman Catholic, look forward to that kind of ecumenical look. As you well know, the National Park Service allows and fosters this kind of service. We do also understand people that have no belief in any faith. I've seen them come, those that have said that they're atheists. They still have a way of connecting with the site, which is for them more of an internal association. And so it's not a case of eliminating anyone, but rather for those that when I see the records of a lot of the USS Arizona crew members, a majority of them have some religion at that time that they put down as their faith. So that's a special moment. The Blackened Canteen ceremony that will take place is a
one. Where did that name come from?
Well, the name Blackened Canteen came from what the canteen represents, a canteen that was recovered in Shizuoka, Japan, from a B-29 that crashed there, actually collided with another B-29, and both of those crews were wiped out. But the Japanese officials, the mayor and others, gave them full burials, which was not necessarily common. The B-29 represented a weapon of terror to the Japanese, and to us it was a weapon to bring the war to an end. And there lies the terrible crucible of war. And so the burials that took place became part of a ritual for the people of Shizuoka to honor them every year on the anniversary of this dramatic bombing. And so I was lucky enough to be invited several years ago to go and be the keynote speaker. And you walk up a mountain, which seems to be endless, but there's water stations because it's in the summer, and I'm in a suit, and I get up there, and I had never seen Mount Fujiyama, by the way. It was one of those things that I longed to find, and the times I was in Tokyo, it was cloudy. And so I get up to a given point, and I look out, and there is Fujiyama in its majesty, and it just takes your breath away. It did for me, anyway, and then I walked 100 yards more, and there was the ceremony on top of this mountain and this monument to our dead. And then, smartly, at attention, were about 50 U.S. Air Force airmen and officer. And I never saw them go up the mountain or anything. So how'd they get here? And then I looked at all the officials and people that were there, some in Japanese traditional dress and other officials in suits. And it just struck me, you know, I'm going to speak to these people. And so I felt very, very humbled and honored by it. You know, you should always, I think, feel a little like, why did they invite me? And obviously they've invited me because I had done some work with others here in reconciliation. And so I gave my remarks, and then the canteen is brought out, and it's all wrinkled from the crash, but it's still intact to hold liquid. And they got the finest American whiskey, put it inside. Everybody that's there that's invited to participate, which was about 25 people, including me, they are handed the canteen, and they pour it over the stone that bears the names of those Americans that died in those B-29s. It was just so powerful. And to walk away and then look back at that ceremony continuing showed me the strength of peace and reconciliation between our two nations, that this was a normal thing. And I grew up in the 1950s and 60s, where we didn't have good feelings about the Japanese. I watched all the propaganda films. Now you say, how did you do that? Well, these were films made by Hollywood during the war, and television needed material. So as a young kid, you know, when you're 5 and 6 years old, did you hear that? That's the call to colors. In about 5 minutes, we'll be playing the national anthem. It happens every day here. And I guess, you know, digressing for just a moment and getting back to the Blackened Canteen, that's what happens here. Every day is Pearl Harbor Day here, and every park ranger knows it. And, you know, with our new staff here, with a new superintendent, with a new chief of interpretation, they come with new qualifications that simply enhance what I've experienced for the last 30-some years. And that's kind of nice. It speaks to the power of that position. But getting back to the Blackened Canteen, it has been, from that day forward, Dr. Sagano, who is the gentleman for Japan that brings the canteen and hosts these ceremonies. At that time, there were a lot of Japanese pilots that were part of the Urabara Kai. And they started showing up in 1991, and every five-year anniversary, they came. And they were part of a reconciliation handshake thing. And it was all cemented by the Blackened Canteen, because they were aware of it, and they associated themselves, in particular Mr. Yoshida, who was a fighter pilot from Japan. And when they were alive, there was this great strength. Now this Blackened Canteen is moving to the next generation, my generation, and then beyond my generation to the next one. And hopefully will continue, because it's one of those seminal moments where, you know, where we get together with our newest partner in the Blackened Canteen is the Pacific Aviation Museum, which wanted to be a part of it. So we invited them to come along. I work with them, and we help co-plan this now. This used to be solely a National Park Service thing. So there's also strength in bringing in new partners. And we'll have well over 100 people or more on the memorial that day when we do the Blackened Canteen. And then the pour actually takes place over the Arizona.
Oh, wow. Bringing it home.
Right. And we're going to have a choir inside. And now we've added a new wrinkle to it. We invite the Japanese liaison officer and the American liaison officer to Japan, because we are, you know, allies and partners. And they do a handshake and salute.
Divert a little bit, you reminded me of a story from the battleship over your shoulder, mm-hmm. the Missouri,
yes.
and the Japanese pilot
right.
who crashed into... Do you remember that story and how the captain dealt with that?
Yeah, well, it's one of those stories that had controversy actually when it was happening, because there was a Japanese aviator that was on a kamikaze mission and struck the side of the Missouri off Japan, and the plane hit very hard, but it threw the pilot onto the deck. And of course, when they were out of danger, they cleaned up the ship and they found the pilot, and the captain made a decision to bury him with military honors. There was a lot of people that were seeing what kamikaze aircraft were doing to other ships and what it almost did to their ship, and so obviously, but the captain took the higher road, and to his credit, he said, we're going to do this, and there's an exhibit now on the Missouri that shows the whole funeral service that was given, and it spoke to the better side of man, and the captain took that decision, not knowing that here we are 70 years later still talking about it. And so I would have loved to met him. I would have loved to interview him, but today it's become part of a new tradition of reconciliation, where it was for some revulsion that they did it, but not all. And that's America. I mean, we find ourselves today in the midst of tumultuous times, that we are politically divided over the future of our country. This is not anything new, but it's people that grow up in these times often think of themselves as unique, and that there's something different and strange about it. But if you go back to just the remembrance of those, that is going to be the national anthem, and we're going to have to stop. May want to record this. How about that?
Yeah, that's pretty touching.
So we were talking about the Blackened Canteen, and so that has now become a component of the December 7th remembrance. And that is something I never saw coming, but over the years of being involved with it, we kept putting it in, and it was accepted. And there was a time, you know, where those kind of things were politically dangerous. And we had to really work carefully with the Pearl Harbor survivors to get their approval for something like that to take a place and explain it to them. And we worked with their leadership. The same for the USS Arizona. I mean, the fact that anything that we used to do to the Arizona, whether it be a modification of the site or the internments or anything, we always consulted with the Arizona Survivors Reunion Association. That, unfortunately, is dwindling, and now it's the sons and daughters that are carrying on the Pearl Harbor survivors, and the sons and daughters carrying on the Arizona Reunion Association. It's significant, though, to also know that part of the collection of the USS Arizona is at the Arizona State Museum and also in Tucson at the university, where you can go now and see part of the Arizona's, you know, silver service, and they have created a new memorial at the university that they will unveil this year that is literally an outline of the ship that is to scale with the names on it.
Oh, wow, that's powerful. A dynamic actually right in front of us, there's a group of Japanese tourists. You see groups of Japanese tourists every day,
right,
all over the place. But the Japanese tourists, right, that you see,
yes,
come here, and
yeah,
it's fascinating. Tell us about that dynamic.
Well, the Japanese visitors that come here, and we refer to everybody that comes here as visitors, but they have read about it in their papers. We've engaged a lot of the Japanese newspapers and media, NHK and such, and over the years they've understood that this is a site that they can come to without the fear of any retribution, which I don't know where that would have come from, because ever since 1991, where we had the major anniversary, there has been a feeling of welcoming the Japanese. We have brochures printed in their language. They were the first language transfer we did. And we also have the audio tour in their language, and that was the first. So we were reaching out. It's sort of like Americans probably going to Germany or Japan. You know, we're not sure how we're going to be treated in those early days after the war, but it became evident that, you know, we weren't the conquerors, but rather being held as partners, and because we were allied together and peacemakers. It seems as if the political apparatus was far ahead of the social apparatus in understanding and accepting the history that was left behind by that war.
You've been here quite a long time.
I've been very fortunate. I came out of here just out of grad school in 1984, the summer of 84, so really the first year, 85, and worked at Little Bighorn as a summer seasonal for 6 seasons. Never wanted to leave. Fell in love with the West and Native Americans and their culture, in particular the Crow and the Sioux and the Cheyenne, Northern Cheyenne. I was really immersed in the culture of that period. But in the back of my mind, I always wanted to see if I could pursue a permanent career in the Park Service. And that opportunity came in 1984 when I was offered a job to come here as a seasonal to see how I would work out, and then be offered a permanent job. And in 1986, I became a permanent employee of the National Park Service. I was a law enforcement ranger and an interpreter. Interpreter is one that gives the talks. And gosh, I was able to literally move up the chain to the position I wanted in 1989, in which I was trained for, was to be the historian for the park. It was a park historian position, and I had been an interpretive skills trainer with other park rangers from other national parks, training park rangers throughout the system on the art of interpretation. When that ended, I kind of went from that, and then I moved into the position, and we were 2 years away from the 50th anniversary. And the incredible pressure of that, which is now returned, seeing so many of this, there was over 6,000 Pearl Harbor survivors,
wow,
and their families that came to the 50th anniversary. And we were the center of it. We had the main events all took place here with a, you know, stage being built and thousands of seats. And so over these decades that I've been here, I've been able to be part of an amazing experience.
Talk to us for a moment about the breadth of your responsibilities in National Park Service here.
The responsibilities, you know, there is one unenviable job in my view, and that's to be the superintendent. Because not only do you have to have all the skill sets to manage a facility of this size and magnitude with a visitation of nearly 2 million people, 1.6 million on tour, and then to make sure, one, that the facilities run properly, two, to make sure grounds and safety, and also your association with the Navy. We're partnered here with the Navy. We're also partnered with partners at the Pacific Aviation Museum, partners at the USS Bofin Submarine Museum, partners with the USS Missouri Memorial and its ship, and then partners with the city, and then partners with the state, and we're partners with the Air Force, the Army. All of this complexity of partnership is what is at stake, and And so this being the icon, the USS Arizona Memorial, which I put on my card because World War II Valor in the Pacific National Monument, people's eyes cross when you say that. But if you say home of the USS Arizona Memorial, then you get a little, you know, glitter in their eye, and then they understand where they are. So, but yes, it is that, not only taking care of for the health and safety of the people that are here, but also for the people that work here. And it's not easy. It's not easy.
Who operates the launches for the Arizona?
That partner I talked about, the USS Arizona, has the U.S. Navy operate our boats. So like at Alcatraz, it's a private contractor that brings you out there with their boats. We have the Navy as our partner, which originally the Navy still operates the boats and takes 150 guests every 15 minutes, starting at 8 o'clock to the memorial and ending at 3:30 each day. The only days we're closed is Christmas, New Year's, and Thanksgiving.
You've been here 3 decades, and in that time, you still have a passion and a fascination.
I think part of it comes from that my family was here. On my mother's side, my grandfather was a Navy federal worker. He was just getting off work from the Red Hill Project above Pearl Harbor. He was down in the harbor when it all started. My mom was at Mass with her mother and her two sisters in St. Patrick's Church in Kaimuckee, where she went to school at Sacred Hearts. So I had that. And then 4 years ago, I find out that, it's a funny story, family reunions are an adventure in themselves. And ours is always a good one. It takes place in Lone Pine, California, where my mom met my dad. And my dad went to high school at Lone Pine High, and so did my mom. And that's how they met. But then I found out that there was another element, the Perez family. And apparently there was a bad marriage that between the Martinez's and the Perez's. No one has ever truly sorted it out. But they didn't talk to each other. And I knew the Perez's. I saw them all the time. I didn't know we were related. Because I went to school up there 1 year, fifth grade. What an adventure that was. Anyway, I got invited to their home. And this was 3 years ago. I knew Matt Perez, because Matt Perez was an FBI agent. All of my, on the Mexican-American side of my family, they're all law enforcement, you know, LAPD. And my brother even just retired from Redondo Beach Police Department, Don. And so we would get together. So I was invited to the Perez's. And Mrs. Perez, who was in her late 80s, 90s, comes up to me while I'm having some nice, wonderful Mexican food, and we're having these great conversations and discovering each other, kind of. She says, you know, my son was at Pearl Harbor. And I said, pardon me? No, Juan, my son, was at Pearl Harbor. And then Matt says, yeah, Dan, didn't you know that? And I says, no. Then she brings out his scrapbook from Schofield Barracks. And I start discovering my cousins. Now think about that. Juan Perez took pictures of everything. And so his album is robust. And then I find out he doesn't come home. He's killed in Okinawa. So I ask, well, where's he buried? And the family says, well, right here in the Lone Pine Cemetery, along with my grandson, who was killed in Vietnam. Now, of the Martinez, Gomez, Dominguez, those families, all had people that served in World War II or Vietnam, Korea. No one lost. Perez family has 2 losses. So I says, well, we'll go and see the grave. And so what's going to happen now is the album is going to be put up online in the next month, and people will be able to page through his album of a young Mexican-American kid who found himself at Schofield Barracks on that fateful day of 7 December and is going to be remembered by the nation by having his album. He did the first drawing that we know of the sunken Arizona in 1942. He was an extra for the movie Gunga Din as a kid that was filmed in Lone Pine. He had a joy of life, you can see by the smiles on his face. He was the From Here to Eternity kid. And so it's with great pride that I have just happened to come to a part of the family's gathering during the Lone Pine reunion and discover my own heritage past. That's
fascinating how things affect and touch everybody.
It is, and it's even hard for me to talk about it right now because I would have loved to have met him.
And in a way, you probably feel like you do know him through his photos.
Yeah, in a stronger sense, scanning the photos, looking at his comments and pictures, the kind of joy and adventure that he was having, not knowing that a war was looming in the distance and that he would be swept up by it. But his album will speak to that optimism and his experience, because I'm also including all the Gunga Din pictures and all of that as part of that adventure of life that ended all too short for him.
He really symbolizes that individual versus the masses of, the millions of people who serve.
It is, and that's what I think that, oral histories and albums and artifacts, they bring that personal touch to a story that is so large in volume that one stops and considers how they could ever understand it. And you could understand it by the experience of a person like him and my grandfather that witnessed the attack. And when I asked my grandfather, Huck Gray, that's what his nickname was, he was known like that, I said, I remember saying to him when I was a kid, we were fishing down in one of the creeks near Lone Pine, and I said, fishing's like being on a golf course, you have time to talk. And so I said to him, don't you hate the Japanese for what they did at Pearl Harbor? And he said, initially, I'm 12 years old, so I don't get the big picture stuff. But he says to me, yeah, initially, yes, we did. But it was almost a necessary part of the war in order to fight it. It was tough, he said, because we lived among Japanese in the islands. And we had to look at them, are they our enemy? And that was tough because he worked with them. And he didn't believe in them as the part of the enemy. But their loyalty was being questioned. And then he went on to say, after I said, don't you hate the Japanese, he paused for a moment and he said, sometime in your life you will feel that emotion towards another country. But you must remember this, that bitterness only brings on more bitterness, that if allowed, time heals all wounds. Now, how did I remember that after all these years? He never said things like that. He's a very quiet, private man, strong, honest. He was 6'3". He was the kindest man I ever knew, and to me, the perfect grandfather. All of us hopefully have that model. I was fortunate to have that with my mom's father. I was also fortunate to have Jose Martinez, my other grandfather, who was a humble individual, could speak English and obviously Spanish, was an immigrant to our nation via the Southern Pacific Railroad that he worked for, and loved America as well as Mexico. He had this juxtaposition. My grandmother was very much the humble and sweet. But we used to love watching my grandfather roll cigarettes. He had it down like an art form. And my brother and I were like 5 or 6 years old watching all of this, and we watched it all through his life. The thing we associated so much with it was that all of his sons served in the military. And he had their picture still as if they were that age. Still on, a place of honor. And so it left me with an impression of both my grandparents, but I think for that thread of reconciliation that I'm so devoted to came from those words from my grandfather, that only bitterness brings on more bitterness.
You talked a little bit ago about the Japanese that lived here, the Issei and Nisei, that were very much inculcated in a part of the community and proud Americans. And yet, as we both know, more than 1,200 were interned here on Oahu.
There was internment on Oahu of not only Japanese Americans, but Italians and German Americans. And in some cases, for the Germans in particular, we know of that there were spies among them. Not many. It's never been proven, other than the Japanese naval spy Takeo Yoshikawa that came here, that there was any spy network among the Japanese Americans that lived here. And as such, they became subject of ridicule and suspicion by the press and by its government and the military as well.
What is the National Park Service here doing to showcase that, to even to take tours to where the internment camp was?
The internment camp, Hanauliuli, that was recently designated by the president, and we're moving forward with that. The superintendent here, Jacqueline Ashwell, is the one that's coordinating that. We're working with the local community here to ensure that that story is told. As a historian, the broader part of that story is the largest amount of internees, certainly not to diminish the Japanese-American experience, were prisoners of war. Who were they? What stories do they tell? How did they happen to come here? What were their names? And the same historical enthusiasm that we have for the Japanese-American experience, we're going to share with the prisoner of war experience.
And where did the prisoners come from? Is there any...
Well, from parts of China, we know that, you know, that they were found. But the detail of that is right now more supposition than history. So we're moving, we're getting now the records. We have a team over at the NOAA facility on Ford Island that are assigned to this, and I just was made aware that we got new records, and I'm anxious to get over there and see them, because I would be able to tell you these prisoners we know came from this place.
Is there any guesstimate as to numbers?
Well, yeah, the numbers are up to maybe, you know, because one of the things, how did they evolve and revolve out of there? But I would say it'd be safe to say that we're looking at anywhere from 1,200 to 2,000 prisoners in that realm. We'll know more. Thing is that when I first came here to Pearl Harbor, there was a lot we didn't know. We didn't know the Japanese casualties. We didn't know who led the air waves. We had two waves of attack here. We didn't know the exact composition of the fleet, a lot of the details. We didn't know a lot about the USS Arizona Memorial, and we did find out more because of Michael Slackman, who was the original contract historian that did the historic resource study, was able to glean some of the mythology that was revolving around this story and get to the real history. And so when I took over in 1989 as the National Park Service historian, I took a lot of Michael's work that was contracted by our association and involved it in a number of documents that we produced. And so the history of Pearl Harbor was so fresh then. I've often been asked by newspaper folks and television, you know, oh, you know so much about Pearl Harbor. Well, I've got to tell you, the more you know is the less you know. And I'm humbled by the amount of work that needs to be done. The kind of historians I run with write major books and share that. Mike Winger, in particular, who is a contract historian that does special projects for us, he's out of North Carolina, is a phenomenal historian. And I learn from him, and in some ways he learns from me. We all have specialties. The man that wrote Shattered Sword, which is a Japanese account of the Battle of Midway, has added an unbelievable perspective. But the scholarship now is becoming rather profound, because...
It's fascinating. This is 75 years later,
yeah.
3/4 of a century.
Yeah, and we have the first handbooks written by the veterans and, you know, generals and admirals, and they're valuable. We have now the reports coming out. We just got the World War II records cleared so that people can use them, because the time is now over 60 years. I think that the renaissance of World War II history is, we're on the edge of it right now.
You know what, Daniel? I could keep you all morning.
Yeah.
And this has been really touching. Anything you want to add before
I one thing to that scholarship. There's a Steve Twomey was a historian. I have a lot of them come to visit. And he was a curious guy. He didn't tell me anything about him, so I didn't know that I was speaking to a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. I'm glad I did, because I'd been intimidated by him. He has written a book called Countdown to Pearl Harbor, 12 Days Before the Attack. And I've read so many Pearl Harbor books, I'd like to tell you that. But that book is incredible. And you're saying, well, why? I mean, A Dawn We Slept, one of the best books ever written about Pearl Harbor, is the seminal study. Day of Infamy by Walter Lord is the introductory book that I read, and it still holds up. So Gordon Prang and his book, At Dawn We Slept, I thought that was it. And here comes Steve. And he writes this book that puts you right on the edge of your seat. I found myself screaming at the book for the purpose of trying to say, stop this. Stop. But the wheels of history are cruel and unkind. And as Steve wrote this drama, it took me back to why I'm here. And that drama of this terrible war that's going to be unleashed here and across the Pacific cannot be stopped. And he captured that moment so vividly with the characters that played critical roles of bad decisions, good decisions.
These are diplomats, these are everybody.
These are the main characters that played such a critical role in the unbelievable drama of Pearl Harbor. You knew at one moment the madness could have been stopped, but those wheels of history crushed it. And then another opportunity crushed. And then those that were involved here militarily will see their careers come undone. The nation will suffer 2,390 casualties, hundreds wounded, its national pride crushed by the surprise attack and defeat at Pearl Harbor, the most profound defeat in naval history of this country. And it left this mark on us that it will never be removed. Simply can't be washed out. And that is that Pearl Harbor changed us.
There were two commanders here.
General Short from the Army.
Yeah, and
Admiral Kimmel.
Kimmel and Short.
Right.
They were scapegoats, weren't they?
People have said that. I do not feel that way at all.
Really?
Not at all.
But that was the end of their careers.
It was. It was unfortunate.
And why do you not?
Well, let me just tell you just briefly that both Kimmel and Short were at the pinnacle of their careers. They were respectively in charge of the Army forces, which included the Air Force. The Army was under the Air Force at that time. There was Army Air Force. They were meant to protect the fleet while it was in port. This was termed by the press and all as a Gibraltar of the Pacific. A large part of America might had been moved from the west coast of the United States to this Gibraltar of the Pacific. Admiral Husband E. Kimmel was in charge of the Pacific Fleet. Both of these took command in January of 1941. It was fairly obvious that the situation in the Pacific was deteriorating. Admiral Richardson, before Admiral Kimmel, had made the cardinal mistake that we see from time to time, that he criticized the president about the movement of the fleet here. And as he was told by one of the cabinet officers, you hurt the president's feelings. And he did. The president loved the fleet. He believed that the best thing to send a message to Japan, that we have now moved our Pacific fleet 2,500 miles closer to Japan, and we mean business. Somehow that escaped Kimmel. And it certainly escaped Admiral Richardson, in my view. I wrote a book with Fred Bork on this topic of responsibility at Pearl Harbor. And I was part of a team that was under Secretary Dorn that looked into whether Kimmel and Short should be reinstated with their stars. And it was unanimous among the group that did the research, the top two judge advocates, Fred Bork, Major Bork being one of them, that this should not happen. The detail of why I feel that would be another sit-down session.
Can you one thing more than any other?
I think that the thing that happened was the war warning that was sent out in late November, advising these commands that war was imminent and they felt it could happen in the next few days. The fact that the fleet was brought in here on the 3rd of December and liberties given, if you look at the roster of ships that had their captains missing that morning, those that were on leave, there was hardly an atmosphere of war here. The early warning system, which was radar, was in place, but there was no confidence in it. There was no way to connect it to the airfields, even if they thought it was a threat. And they indeed did pick up the planes. The thing is the Secretary of War and the Secretary of Navy looked at this, and in particular, the Secretary of Navy came out here and immediately, within a week of the attack, was here investigating and came back, told the President they were asleep at the switch. The thing is that it wasn't partisan. He was a Republican in the administration, and that's the problem with Pearl Harbor. It becomes very partisan, and it's hurtful to the Kimmel and Short families, some of their relatives feeling the shame of that. But those that serve understand, whether they be a superintendent of a national park or they be a chief historian, admiral in the Navy, or general in the Army, that ultimately the responsibility of command rests on the shoulders. And in this case, it fell upon them, and that they were removed. And in their place were other generals and other admirals. And in particular in Kimmel's, it was a man named Nimitz that replaced him. So the verdict of history can be harsh, and for some families they will never accept it, and I respect that and understand it. But the verdict of history, in my view, was that they should be removed because of what happened under their command. And it's part of the rules of engagement when you become an officer in the Navy or the other branches of service. And it can be harsh and it can be cruel.
I hate to say it, Daniel Martinez, but I've got to let you go. I know you have work to do. It's been an absolute honor to spend the morning with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming today, and I hope they'll all that have the opportunity to listen to this, that be open, understand that it's a lesson of history that still shadows us today. And the whole Cold War mentality was that we would never have a Pearl Harbor repeated. And in some ways, 9/11 was a partial reminder of that. It wasn't a military attack, but a terrorist attack. But in these troubled times, we have to keep in mind that Pearl Harbor is that object lesson of history. And how we use that object or lesson of history is the real key.
Daniel, thanks again.
You're welcome, and aloha from Pearl Harbor.
We've been speaking with Daniel Martinez, Chief Historian at the National Park Service World War II Valor in the Pacific National Monument, the home of the USS Arizona Memorial in Honolulu, Hawaii.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory, produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomascwilmer.com. Our associate producers from the San Francisco Bay Area include Molly Blaisdell, Lori King, and Susie Rodriguez. Melissa Corbin reporting from Knoxville, Tennessee, Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Kim Schneider from Michigan, Elaine Masters in San Diego, Julie Henning, Eugene, Oregon, Rebecca Bingham, Hot Springs, Arkansas, and Steve Cook, contributing from Little Rock, Arkansas, host of Arkansongs on NPR affiliate KUAR. America, America, America.